From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am your congenial host, Mr. Hunter Deusing. And with me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado is Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello, buds.
Hey, buds. Smoking some buds.
Yeah, that's all Colorado does now.
Yeah.
That and root for the Broncos.
Yep.
That's all we like to do. And ski. We like to ski.
Well, as we're recording this, a bunch of people are getting killed in Paris at an Eagles of Death Metal show.
Yeah, we don't know the total story behind it.
Mm-hmm. We don't want to speculate, John.
I don't want to speculate.
I don't want to speculate.
It may feed the hate that's out there. So.
Mm-hmm. We cannot recognize. Okay, I'm seeing now the number reads 160 plus dead.
Jesus.
It was 100 plus earlier. And
that's because I think shootings are still going on.
Yeah, it's at least 118 killed in gunfire and blasts. That's on CNN.
Not even looking at the Sky News feed right now, which I think was in a loop. But yes, I have Roku, so I do what's free. So
yeah.
Just Sky News. Because CNN and Fox will not give you a free live feed on Roku.
No, and they you have to buy a shitty cable package for that.
Right? No, not doing that. I'll put up with those stiff British accents.
Yep.
For news, and I'll just keep it on Sky News.
Yep.
Which, strangely enough, runs the CBS news for a couple of hours.
I don't even know how to deal with it. And I love the Eagles of Death Metal. They're one of my favorite, you know, I love that desert rock scene, Caius and Queens of the Stone Age. And
I love those guys too. I've seen the Eagles of Death Metal live. Fantastic live show.
Such a great band. And this is the worst sort. And I just love on the news, the death metal show. There's a massacre at a death metal show. They sound like Little Richard.
Yeah, it's more like a Chuck Berry Little Richard.
Yeah, it's Boogie Woogie. Else. Like, I have the vinyl of the new album Zipper Down, and there's mm-hmm. Side Boogie and Side Woogie, you know. And the documentary on the – they were, like, toying with different names, and there was, like, Crazer Beam, and
you know, the Eagles of Death Metal are what I think punk should sound like.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, because to me the early punk records were continuing the Chuck Berry – Little Richard Elvis tradition.
Yeah, they had the rockabilly style, you know, edge.
Almost. Right. They skipped that whole 60s kind of pretentiousness. And that's what we all liked about them. And but then, like, in the 80s, it just became, you know, it somehow whittled down to Jello Biafra being like, oh, corporations, you know.
Oh, it became political.
Right. Oh, politics. Let me quote Chomsky. You know, and it's just like,
I'm going to go on a spoken word tour.
I think that destroyed punk music for, you know, general acceptance for the most part. I mean, you know, Green Day got big or whatever, if you even want to call it
punk.
You got
the pop punk bands in the 90s.
Right. I mean, you got all that, but...
Where every song is about pizza and leaving this town. Gotta get out of this town.
We're gonna have blindest pizza across from Gilman Street. You know.
La, 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 la.
Right, some ska beats and stuff. Yeah. I mean, but... In truth, the 90s punk was actually superior to a lot of the 80s punk. I mean,
well, it had more in common with, like, it was like the Ramones, but they could play, you know?
Right.
Because like, to the Ramones, they wanted to be pop musicians.
Yeah, they wanted to be the American Slade.
Like, they worked with fucking Phil Spector.
Right. They wanted to be a cross between Slade and the Ronettes.
Yeah, and, like, they also talk about the Bay City Rollers, you know?
Oh, the Sky News now has the Eagles of Death Metal Twitter page.
Mm.
Like, they're now showing that. So their Sky News got hip to the fact that they were not. Yeah. It was not a heavy metal concert.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, best of luck to all good spirits in Paris.
I guess
I can just hope for the best. I'm not going to stay up all night and watch the news. It'll drive me crazy. It's not.
Yeah, this is one of those things where I'm going to have to shut off for a bit. As much as I,
yeah,
as much as I'm enjoying some of the comments being made.
I have faith in the Parisian police. French police are actually badasses, despite all our stereotypes.
And that, well, they listen. You look at their tough guys. They've got Vincent Cassel in their movies.
I've seen enough of those movies to know that their SWAT teams are ruthless. But here's the thing: they're not like, you know, you read about the Columbine High School incident where the SWAT team stood down in front of the school for hours. They don't do that in France.
No, they kill.
They're eager to use those weapons and do some killing. So, you know, I don't want to cast any suspicions on who the terrorists involved are, but let's just say I hope to wake up in the morning and hope to hear that they've, you know, put bullets in a bunch of you know, those people.
The John, may I remind you that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Yes, I'm gonna love all those mealy mouth liberals.
On
the media tomorrow to see what they say.
Like you said to me earlier, though, you said something great, and that was that the best thing about this is that it kicks all those college douchebags out of the headlines.
Oh God, I don't want to ever read about another fucking college protest.
Have you noticed that, like, you have all these black students and they're demanding segregation? What's up? Seriously, they're like, we want our black safe space, so you want segregation, okay? We demand segregation at our schools. That's the progressive thing to do.
I listened to one of those idiots, because Anthony Acumia was playing one of those videos, and I have tried to ignore that story as much as possible, seriously. They're not even smart. They don't belong in college.
No, they don't. They're dumb people.
Yeah, it's like they just got into college, but they're not taking advantage of it.
Speaking of Kumia, I just got a notification. Live now, terror in France. So they must be doing a live show.
No! We're missing out. Well, I know, and I'll have it on after I'm done.
But anyway, just felt the need to comment on it, because it's kind of like we sat down to record this a little while ago, and we just ended up spending a couple hours commenting, just reading the news.
It was tough, because this is happening now, and so this will be a nice little time capsule for our afternoon stress as we sit around with our dogs.
I know.
And at my house, bitchy cats, so, you know, because I have a dog and three cats.
I'm looking forward to school on Monday. Anyway.
It is history in the making, though.
It is. It's, you know, we'll see. Maybe it's either the decline or the recovery of Europe. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe this will wise everybody up.
Maybe. I don't know. Time to wake up and smell what's cooking in your backyard.
Yeah, but Hunter, we're here to talk about something.
We're here to talk about kids' movies!
Nostalgia! Woo! Violent, gory kids films that we're probably getting an R rating today.
Yes. These movies are the kind that you notice your kid becomes more violent after he watches it. He's hitting people. He's doing kung fu moves. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Super Inframan.
Yes. Or as I saw it in theaters, Inframan.
Yeah, there's Inframan. This is our second attempt to record this, by the way. And I was calling it Inframan because I thought Inframan was the title, and you informed me that Super Inframan is the title. So... As far as the original Chinese version goes.
Right. It was called the Super Inframan in Hong Kong, where it was released in 1975. And it got a very quickly picked up for release in 1976 for American release by Joseph Brenner and Associates. And I talked to Basil Gogos, the cover artist of Famous Monsters.
Yeah,
it's still around, still doing signings.
Can't believe he's still alive. I was like,
I know. Funny thing is, when I talked to him 20 something years ago, he had a head of white gray hair, and now he has black hair. So, don't know what's going on there. but Basil was so nice, and he told me that Joseph Brenner screened Inframan for him because he did the poster, and which you could probably find on eBay for a crazy price. He did the poster, and he saw the film in a screening room, and Joseph Brenner asked him what he thought about it. He goes, "Oh, I think it's wonderful. Kids are going to love this film. They're going to really go crazy for it." And Joseph Brenner's plans were to release toys, coloring books, puzzles, action figures. He was very ambitious. He thought he might have like a big merchandising thing. And you've got to remember back then, before Star Wars, merchandising was not a big thing with movies.
Like, when people talk about merch for a movie pre-Star Wars, you kind of think Planet of the Apes, right?
That's about it. That was the
about
most,
it, yeah.
Most aggressive. Like, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea was, like, one of the most popular science fiction TV shows of the 60s, and you would think, oh, man, there must have been tons of toys tied in with it. No, there was, like,
well, and
one,
that's the thing is, when
one
George
CVU
Lucas,
model, I think, and that was it.
When George Lucas gave up some of his stuff on Star Wars to get the toys, the rights to the toys, and the studio was like, why do you want that? That's worthless.
Yeah.
And
right.
they laughed at him, and, you know, that's where he made his fortune.
Now, it's true, and unfortunately, Joseph Brenner did not go forward with merchandising plans, because I think that would have made the film even bigger. Because it, you know, contrary to the snarky crap you read today, this movie was a hit in theaters in the 1970s.
Well, and all you have to do is look at some of the monsters and go, oh, the people who saw Ghostbusters saw this. You know, the
yes.
Evil Queen looks just like Zool. You know, when
right,
she's in
right.
a monster
Princess,
form.
Princess Dragon Mom, who yeah. in the Chinese version, she I think she's like Princess Beelzebub or something, like Princess Devil, or however you want to do it. The original Chinese version is more tied in with old myths and mythology, including Western mythology. The American dub, and it was, by the way, there was a Hong Kong dub done in 1975 by Ted Thomas and his crew. And they do all the dubs for the Shaw Brothers action films, you know, and they're the ones that say, but still, right then, in the intercontinental.
Right, right.
They did an Inframan dub. It's never been heard or seen anywhere.
Yeah.
And because when Joseph Brenner got it, or picked up the rights from Shaw Brothers, he did not like the Chinese, you know, the English dub that they had on it. So he had it re-recorded in New York and by the crew that did Speed Racer and the Sonny Chiba films, led by Pete Fernandez and Corrine Orr. And so Brenner had the music rescored a bit to a more kind of throbbing electronic Moog beat and stuff. It's really cool. The opening credit sequence is different. It's more westernized, and I think it's actually better. It's superior to the Chinese cut. Friends of mine who purchased like videotapes from around the world, right, from Korea, from Germany, from various countries. Every time they get a tape or video, it's the Joseph Brenner version.
Mm-hmm.
That became the accepted international version. This film was four-walled back in the 70s in most American theaters. Four-walling, if I haven't explained it on the show before, and I realize not all our listeners have heard every show, so they're not going to be like, oh, yeah. You know,
oh, yeah, four-walling, that thing.
Right, right. Four-walling was when you kind of released it regionally around the country. You released it in maybe, you know, six or seven theaters in the state. And advertise it aggressively on television. You often sent your own people in to project it. Inframan was four-walled with a unique stereo track, which was not common with every film at the time. Even major studio films were not always in stereo. And it was billed as infrasound. And so the stereo was amazing. It was like monsters flying over. You know, it was like every time Inframan would hit one of the creatures, there would be this giant thunderous boom of the Shaw Brothers sound effect, but amplified. You know, it drove me crazy when I was eight because I'd never seen a movie like this.
Mm-hmm.
I had never seen a kung fu film. They weren't shown on television. My dad was not going to take me to an R-rated kung fu film. It just was going to happen. So Inframan was the first Chinese film I ever saw. It just amazed me. It really sucked me in the way probably Star Wars or Empire Strikes Back, you know, absorbed other kids my age. But it's like, for me, this was the film. And you got to also remember, there were no real superhero films at the time that look like comic books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this Christopher Reeve Superman movie doesn't look like a comic book. It just looks like a movie with Superman in it.
It looks like a prestige picture.
Right, and this looked like Jack Kirby panels brought to life.
Yeah.
It really did. You have a superhero fighting monsters, and it just those really wonderful Shaw Brothers sets that they redressed from all their swordplay epics into like science fiction sets is just amazing. And I mean, it's such a cool film. It's also a popular cult movie too. I mean, most people who are listening to this have probably seen it at least once.
Well, and it's a Shaw Brothers film, even though it looks like the Japanese superhero movies, like Ultraman. Like what are those called? There's like a name for them.
Tokusatsu.
Tokusatsu.
They're not kaiju, but they're tokusatsu, which is Japanese superhero live action fantasy TV shows and movies.
It's very much in that vein.
Yeah, and it has some Japanese talent that did work on the film. A suit designer, and August Rigoni wrote these really good notes liner notes for the American DVD release that Image put out. We'll talk more about that later. But he said that a Japanese designer actually did the artwork to design the creatures, gave the Hong Kong crew notes on how to make the suits, and was a little ticked off because when he got there, apparently they'd already designed Inframan's helmet and mask. And so he had to design the suit to complement what they... He didn't like what they created.
Yeah, so he was like, oh, great. I
probably thought the eyes were too big and the antenna. And I mean, he kind of resembles a Toei superhero called Inazu Man, which means Lightning Man in Japanese. And if you Google that, you'll kind of notice the huge bug eyes and the lightning bolts coming out of his helmet. They're like antennas, just like Inframan has the big antennas and stuff. But he basically left all that stuff with him, and apparently when he came back and saw what they built, he wasn't too pleased.
Yeah.
So they do have that kind of wonky off-market look of a Japanese superhero show, but it looks like an imitation. But it's very creative, and I mean, as a kid, I just didn't care. I just loved that I had this unapologetic superhero film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being presented to me in a theater. It's, you know, it's it when you're a little kid learning how to read with Marvel Comics and stuff, you want to see that stuff brought to life. And I know this will tick off the usual listeners who get tired of my rantings against superhero movies, which I don't really despise them. I just think,
hi Dan,
a lot of them are boring. It's like you look at the Marvel Comics movies and they're like sitcoms where the actors never really want to wear the suits or the mask. Like
right.
Winter Soldier is like 95% of it's like an imitation of a Bourne Identity movie.
Yeah.
And then 5% of it is the actor in the Captain America costume being Captain America. It's kind of like, it's as bad as the Red Brown TV movies.
I liked Winter Soldier. But
no, I mean, as a movie, it's okay. It's fun. It's watchable. But it still doesn't feel like a Captain America superhero movie, you know?
No, it doesn't. I get you what you're saying there. But so with Inframan,
mm-hmm.
Who was the director of the movie?
It was Hua Shan, who's mainly did fantasy oriented wuxia films.
Okay. Any noteworthy ones you might have heard of?
He did one called Urspur of the Emperor's Power.
Okay.
Which I have seen, and I recently got a new version of, but I've not watched yet. And it was a more wire work before they called it wire work, you know, kung fu sword film. Decent, mm-hmm. not great. He did stuff that had a little more visual kick to it. Like,
okay.
I think they trusted him to handle like a fantasy oriented film. I just got tons of Shaw Brothers films that I've not seen to watch for the winter, so I'm hoping to see some wash on stuff. He also did some like a crime film called, I think it was To Kill a Jaguar, which was, it was interesting. It was a real sleazy graphic crime movie with Nora Mao, and it wasn't bad. It was mostly interesting, not a great film or anything, but it's interesting to see that they were doing other things besides the Chang Che kung fu films and the Liu Jialiang movies that I've watched over and over again.
Right.
I figure it's probably time I started expanding beyond my usual comfort zone with the Shaw Brothers output.
And it stars Danny Lee, who listeners may know from The Killer, the John Woo film.
Yeah, very. Danny Lee was a leading man in Shaw Brothers films in the 70s. Not like a huge star. He did Mighty Peking Man, which was released in theaters in America as Goliathon.
Mm-hmm. I love 70s. That movie. I have the Quentin Tarantino's label version of it.
It is a blast. I only have a Hong
so
Kong
much
version.
Fun.
I should hunt down the Rolling Thunder DVD.
Yeah, that's what I have. The Rolling Thunder. That's thank you. That's what
because it has the English dub. Danny Lee also played Bruce Lee in the first real Bruce Lee biopic, which was Bruce Lee: His Last Days, His Last Nights, which was based on the memoirs and inspiration of Betty Ting Pei, Bruce's mistress. So it was very much hated by the Bruce Lee fans at the time, although in retrospect, it's probably the most truthful biopic about Bruce Lee.
Because it doesn't have the Lee estate all over it.
Right, it's not
controlling everything.
It is not peachy and cool about, you know, how Bruce, it doesn't really look at him.
It doesn't paint him as this fucking saint.
No, not at all. It's probably the most negative portrayal, but that's why I also think it's the most truthful.
Right.
It has him as kind of a cocky show-off
mm-hmm.
with a mode for sex with Betty Ting Pei and you know, rather erratic behavior, which matches a lot of the kind of unofficial stuff I've heard and read about Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
In his last year in Hong Kong. I'm not saying he was always like that. I'm just saying that those last couple of years in Hong Kong, the behavior.
Well, he was staying up like late, working all day, mm-hmm. you know, partying, you know, he's
yeah, trying to be Mr. Hollywood in Hong Kong.
Yeah. I mean, he was kind of living this party lifestyle. Meanwhile, shooting these physically demanding movies.
Right. And I really feel like the Betty Ting Pei movie is a lot closer to the truth. And I think Danny Lee's performance underrated. I think he's playing the real Bruce.
And speaking of Bruce exploitation, we have Bruce Lee in this
yes.
movie as well.
Yeah, Wan Hung Quan Long, I think, was his real Chinese name. He was, before he was a Bruce clone, he was a bit player at Shaw Brothers because in the early 70s, there was this kind of push to hire martial artists because the Bruce Lee films were big. The boxing films, like Five Fingers of Death, that's what they call them in Hong Kong. They don't call them kung fu movies or boxing movies.
Oh, really?
Yes. Oh, there's
and,
a little
And
little
in the black community, they call them karate movies.
Karate flicks. They were called boxing films, and so Five Fingers of Death was a boxing, meaning hand-to-hand combat. They'd had sword films for years.
Yeah, the wuxia movies.
Right, they had their Hungar movies with the Wong Fei-Hung series starting in like the late 40s or early 50s. Like those, there was like 100 of those movies, but actual violent boxing cinema, as we would call it, really started with King Boxer, or as we know it as Five Fingers of Death. Now
that
we
movie,
know
that movie fucking rules.
Yeah, and so there was this kind of push to start hiring real martial artists, and especially with Bruce Lee's The Big Boss being this cheap movie that made a fortune.
Yeah.
And so it was getting worldwide attention, so they're like, okay, we got to start hiring martial artists. So Shaw Brothers hired Ching Quan Tai. I think they actually hired Ching Quan Tai before, actually a couple of years before Bruce was making movies, and he was a Kung Fu tournament champion. And I think he may have even appeared in some of the later Wong Fei-Hung movies, and he was very skilled, so they started hiring more martial artists based on their martial arts skills, because they were going to put them in acting classes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all this nonsense you hear, like, oh, they had martial artists that couldn't act. Bullshit. If you were hired by the Shaw Brothers studio, you had to go to acting classes, you had to go to screen fighting classes, mm-hmm. tutelage under Liu Jialiang and Tang Cha and all these guys. You were trained before you got in front of the camera. And so Wan Quan Lung was one of those, or Hung Quan Lung, is who later became Bruce Lee. He was in some Shaw Brothers movies, bit parts. He was never technically starred in anything. It was always a supporting role. And he has this role in Inframan as a member of the Science Patrol staff or whatever they're called. And he fights some monsters. And then literally a year later, when there was that kind of demand for Bruce clones, he decided, hey, I'll make more money if I go work for these indie producers because I have a vague resemblance to Bruce Lee and I have this Beatles haircut. So I'll go make some films on the cheap. And a lot of his movies were shot in like 2 weeks,
yeah.
4 days. I mean, his stuff was shot quick. And many of them were Filipino co-productions because the fact is most of those Bruce Lee clone movies were they were not made for the Hong Kong market.
Right.
That's a little known thing. They were made for third world markets that just wanted action films. They didn't want culturally knowledgeable, you know, historically accurate sword films.
They want Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Right, right. They didn't want stuff like that. They wanted just cheap, basically Charles Bronson movies with kung fu fighting.
Yes.
You know, that's what they wanted. They wanted revenge pictures. And so the Bruce Lee clone market, that's what that satisfied. So a lot of people would say he was a fool to leave Shaw Brothers Studio. I think he probably did the right thing money-wise because he probably made so much money being Bruce L.E.
Mm-hmm.
Lee, I always called him. A friend of mine always called him Bruce Lur because he couldn't stand him.
Bruce Lur.
Bruce Lur. He hated him. And it's like he made those movies because he had a profit, you know, participation in them because I think he was a producer on a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he made way more money. Funny thing about him is he has a cameo in Jean-Picard Simon's Pieces, basically it's himself, where he runs into, I think he does a fight scene and says, oh, sorry, I eat bad chop sake. I think he's playing like a professor.
Bad chop sake.
Anybody who's seen Pieces will recognize the scene that I'm talking about. And he also did a movie with Robert Patrick in the Philippines called Future Hunters, which was a science fiction kung fu film, or karate flick.
Karate.
where Robert Patrick has a fight scene with Wong Ching Lee, the great Korean leg fighter who was the villain in Drunken Master and Snake of the Eagle Shadow and Secret Rivals and countless other films. Just probably the best leg fighter ever on screen. And Wong Ching Lee has a fight scene with Robert Patrick. And it was Robert Patrick's first film role, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And, something I don't think he likes to talk about or mention, you know, but it's pretty fun. And so Bruce Lee did have a career after Inframan, and it's funny because he probably was a bigger star worldwide than Danny Lee was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Danny Lee was a leading man in these Shaw films, but was not really a star until he made a film called Cop on the Town. I think it was in 1986. It was a cop thriller. The first one to portray police officers very realistically and glorify them quite a bit. And
The thing about cop movies in Hong Kong. They love the police. You know, they're very pro-cop movies.
Danny really started that trend, and he had formed a production company called Magnum Pictures. Basically, all they made was cop thrillers, cop comedies.
Cop drama.
Starring Danny Lee. So when Danny Lee made The Killer with John Woo directing, it was a co-production between Magnum Productions and Chewy Hark's Film Workshop.
Okay.
So that Danny Lee's career was like that. I mean, he was so beloved by the police. Like, they practically considered him one of their own because he always portrayed a good police officer in these films. And so that became his career long after Inframan. He is not probably wearing the costume 60% of the time. I don't know. I don't even know how to estimate it, but it's not him doing the acrobatic action.
So, he's not doing the stunts and stuff.
No, he does some fighting. I mean, he's trained in some basic screen fighting, but he was not an acrobat or a martial artist. I suspect, and I have confirmed that they both worked on the film, that a lot of the Inframan stuff was done by either Yun Hua, who was Bruce Lee's double in Enter the Dragon doing the backflips, and later became... played many villain roles in Sammo Hung films like Eastern Condors.
And then the other one was Casanova Wong.
I wish. Inframan would have...
I just remember one time we were like, it was Casanova Wong, probably.
Wicked roundhouse kicks if it had been Casanova Wong. But no, it was Chen Ye Xing, I suspect, because Chen Ye Xing, he's that kind of ugly actor, but a real tremendous talent who had co-starred Three Avengers with Bruce Lai, which we covered a year ago. And... Chen Ye Xing can do all the acrobatic moves that Inframan does, but so can Yun Hua. So it could be either one. And it could be both. Or it could be a stuntman that I don't even know who wore that suit. There's another great skilled stuntman who, doesn't work in the industry anymore. But I do know those two guys worked on it. It's a very good chance one or the other is doing the Inframan stuff.
And that was one thing we talked about with this movie was that you said that I know you said Danny Lee's, you know, he's not Inframan in it, but one thing you talked about was that because you see in the movie, you see Danny Lee doing a lot of the fighting.
Yeah.
Like you see him fighting as, you know, out of the Inframan costume. And then you get the transformation sequence where he transforms into Inframan. And you talked about how that was something that was really exciting that's kind of missing from superhero movies today.
Yeah, every time he showed up, the way it's designed and edited or where he changes an Inframan, he does like four flips in front of the sun. And and the music and sound effects kick in. And that's completely designed to get kids in the audience excited that Inframan is appearing.
Yeah.
That is totally missing from DC and Marvel movies today. There is no excitement when those characters show up in costume.
And it's
just
like
none.
Cause like, and I think of other examples, like, you know, you'd watch The Electric Company and you'd look to see if it was going to be a Spider-Man episode.
Right. It's only Electric Company. That's all I did was wait for the Spider-Man.
Or is the Batgirl motorcycle going to drive by?
Yeah.
The opening of Batman with Adam West. I mean, you know, is Batgirl going to show up?
Right. Come on.
And didn't like Linda Carter have some like thing? I've never seen Wonder Woman with her, but didn't she have some sort of transformation sequence?
When Diana Prince would transform.
Or Diana Prince? Who did?
Yeah, she would spin and there would be this circle of like blue and red light. And she became Wonder Woman. It was actually pretty exciting for television at the time. Now you look at it, it's like, God, the show was awful. But it's like, wow, what a cheap show. But it was exciting. It was designed to be exciting when she showed up. And that's what Inframan did, because it was kind of based on the way in Japanese superhero shows like Ultraman and Kamen Rider, a theme music would happen, sound effects, light effects, everything when the hero appeared in costume. Mm-hmm. And it was designed to get kids, yes, cheering. And that's the way it was designed to get kids to cheer in the theater every time Inframan showed up. And it was, here's the thing, in the movie it works. It's always exciting when he turns into Inframan.
Yeah, you're kind of waiting for it to happen.
Because you just know shit just got real. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, and the plant monster is doomed. You know, the crazy looking monster with the silver boxing glove or whatever. It's like
silver,
the drill arm.
There's there's that big red furry character from Looney Tunes, the sort of big red furry guy with eyeballs.
Oh, the Gossamer.
The Gossamer. It looks like him with Down syndrome, and he's black.
Well, I love it that he's dubbed with like a voice that I've heard on Speed Racer for the bad guys.
Yeah,
the pops, right? We're like, well, and the monsters refer to all the people on Earth as Earthlings.
Well,
even though they're from under the ground, Earthlings.
Yeah, living surface dwellers. And you brought up the dub. That was one thing. Like when I watch a Shaw Brothers movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
I always watch it with the English dub. Now, a lot of cinema purists, like quote-unquote purists, the type in America, think that it's wrong to watch anything with dubbing. You have to watch everything in its native language, which is bullshit. Because especially Italian and Hong Kong movies, you know, they didn't record them with sound. You know, there's no pure version of these films.
No, there's no original language version at all.
Like if you watch like an art house movie like Fellini's La Strada, Anthony Quinn and the actor who plays the clown that's always picking on Anthony Quinn's character, those are American actors. They're speaking English the whole time. Everybody else in the movie is speaking Italian. So if you watch the English track, you're getting their voices and dubs on everyone else. If you watch the Italian version, those two leads are getting dubbed in Italian. Yeah. Everybody else is speaking their native language. So there's no pure version of those movies. And those are revered movies. So this is something you got to get over. The purism. But anyway,
that's an American thing.
It is an American thing. Other audiences don't give a shit.
Every other countries, all these sophisticated countries like Japan and France and Germany and whatever, it's like they don't care if it's dubbed.
No,
they
don't.
It's in their language. They don't want to read subtitles. They don't give a damn. It's like they just want to watch the movie.
They just want to get immersed into it.
And I know very smart people who absolutely hate subtitles. They don't want to read a film while they're watching.
Yeah.
Because it's double stress. You know, it's like, and I know, and this is so funny because anime fans are the worst about this.
Oh, they hate, you're absolutely right.
The percentage of Japanese animation directors who would prefer you to watch the English dub version is very great.
Yes.
They don't want you reading subtitles and missing out on the art.
Yeah, no, it's true. And the dubs of animes are actually pretty good most of the time. It's just these people, they're the type of people who like to go around correcting everybody.
Yeah, they're nerds.
Yeah,
a lot of nerd rage.
Yeah, they like to, when you say, uh-oh, you're watching Dragon Ball Z, and you're like, shut up! You're like, oh, shit, Goku's about to go Super Saiyan. They'll go, excuse me, Son Goku is about to go Super Saiyajin. Okay, fuck off.
Yeah.
You know?
I was thinking how that word nerd has been completely overused to where it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it's true.
Like, because now you can be a gym nerd, you can be a jujitsu nerd. It doesn't... Nerd, when I was growing up, meant a really weird, overly intellectual, possibly on the autism spectrum person.
Yeah.
And of course, now we know that more people were autistic than anybody ever realized.
Sure.
They spot it a lot easier now.
By the way, John, what's it like to be autistic?
It's not that bad because, you know, hey man, you know, like I don't even view it as anything. But no, it's just like, but it meant like a person that really didn't think emotionally and never tried to better themselves. Like, you would see, I didn't think they really existed, except in, like, stupid slob comedies, until I, like, went to a horror convention.
Oh, God, yeah.
And you'd see these kind of asthmatic 30-somethings who never did a push-up in their life, pale skin, Buddy Holly glasses, and this is the early 90s when nobody wore those. And
this was also before Comic-Con became Hollywood's go-to.
Right. And you know, dressing just really, like, they shake your hand, and the hand would go dead in your hand, like, with no grip. You know, when I shake your hand, I give you a grip.
Yeah, that's...
Manly.
Any man shakes your hand, if he gives you the dead fish, like, puts out his hand.
Like,
I have a friend who used to put out his hand like he wanted you to kiss it or something. It was the worst, you know?
Right. It's just like, you know, like, shake hands with him, and just the hand is just limp in your hand. It's like, but that was what a nerd was. Now nerd means, oh, I'm a food nerd. I'm a beer
nerd.
I'm a wine nerd. I'm a whiskey nerd.
It means you're into something. You know?
Yeah. It's just like that word is completely distorted. And I would guess the theory is maybe because nerds are basically in charge of everything now.
Or are the real nerds, are they like the American Indian? They're drunk on a reservation somewhere. You don't see them.
Well, they're
they've been forced out by the fake nerds.
Sheriff Longmire has taken my chessboard. It's just like, I guess it's because Bill Gates, when he became one of the richest men on Earth, and Steve Jobs, and this kind of deification of these guys, or deification of the nerd, and that just all changed. Like, suddenly it became this varied word with tons of meanings. I guess it's because English is derived from Anglo-Saxon, and they kind of invented the dual meaning of words, but it's been completely taken beyond what it used to mean.
Yeah. So earlier, what I was getting to was that when I put on Inframan to watch it again, I put on the English dub, and something was wrong. And like you said, it was the Peter Fernandez crew that did Speed Racer that did the dubbing, not the typical Shaw Brothers in-house guys that would do it. And that was something that I ended up watching it in Mandarin because I wasn't getting my Shaw Brothers dubbing that I wanted. So I ended up watching the Mandarin track on the Image DVD, and plus the sound's better anyway. I started watching it, and I was like, boy, this opening credit sequence looks exciting, but the music's fucking dull. Like, it was like, you know, Casio keyboard, like,
well,
and then I switched over to the Mandarin track, and it's like, and I'm like, oh, that's more like it.
Well, the lively Hong Kong soundtrack. Well, the truth is, the American soundtrack used to be superior. The reason is when Image DVD when Image was working on the DVD, they had to acquire the English soundtrack. And yeah, here's a dirty little secret of the industry. They don't hunt down a 35 millimeter to take the audio track off of it.
No.
They'll use a videotape if they have to. And they're more than likely to resort to a videotape than they'd ever admit to you. Image was getting a videotape, and there have been two official video releases of Inframan on VHS. There was a Prism Entertainment videotape of the 1980s in a big clamshell box that had, the stereo soundtrack heard in theaters. Mm-hmm. And in hi-fi, sounded great. And there was a second release by Good Times Home Video, license, but 4-hour speed mono, because it's Good Times Home Video. They'd also, I've never seen it, supposedly has an opening credit scene that introduces the monsters and gives them names, which I was never aware of that version. So I've never seen this, but supposedly that's what it had. There was also a very quick release that was pulled almost immediately by Sinister Cinema. I did manage to get that. I think I may still be sitting on that videotape. But it also did not have the stereo track, because Sinister Cinema did not ever have the best video or film the video transfer equipment.
Sinister Cinema just dump stuff onto.
Yeah, they had a 35 millimeter print. They transferred it. It looked good. It was the only way to see it in widescreen. Of course, being Sinister Cinema, they didn't do a scope transfer. They did a 1.85 with a squeezed image. So it sucked.
And also, you're never, ever, ever, ever going to get subtitles if it's a movie that's not in English.
Right.
I have the and I knew it ahead of time, but I got their edition of Paul Feyhaus's Fantomas.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's fun to look at, but it's not no subtitles, you know?
Yeah. So, better get the Rosetta Stone for that language.
Exactly. But that's the only release of that movie that's available, you know?
Yeah, they had to pull it because Joseph Brenner, in the 1990s, was extremely strict about claiming his copyright on that film, which he had every right to, I'm sure.
Of course, yeah.
In fact, a fanzine editor, he put Inframan in a comic strip fanzine he was doing. He included the Inframan character, and he got a cease and desist from Joseph Brenner. Mm-hmm. And he was so freaked out by that. He got an actual legal warning and everything. So then about like a couple of weeks later, and I've only heard this through the grapevine, I didn't hear it from the guy himself, Joseph Brenner contacted him and said, you know, maybe it's time to do an Inframan comic book. And this is like the 1980s. And he's like, how about we'll do an Inframan comic book? The guy was so freaked out by the cease and desist, he just didn't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, but Joseph Brenner was like, oh, maybe now I'll exploit this for comic books. Because apparently that was his plan when he bought it from the Shaw Brothers. Like Basil Gogo said, he was going to put out comic books and tons of merchandise. He never did. There was no tie-in product to Inframan that I know of. And I have heard no one's ever produced a figure to confirm it. But a friend of mine saw Inframan in the Hawaiian Chinatowns in 1975. And they were selling an action figure of Inframan in the lobby as a tie-in. And this is in the Chinatown release. And his dad would not buy it for him. And if his dad had purchased that for him, he'd probably still have it today. And we would have evidence of it. And I've had some people say they probably just redressed a Kamen Rider figure. I actually think they may have produced Inframan action figures in Hong Kong. Because in the early 70s, Hong Kong was a... one of the main markets for producing a lot of cheap plastic dinosaur toys.
But did they ever merchandise their movies though? Did they ever do that? Because I know Hong Kong notoriously has not given a shit about their movies. Like
they don't. No, and I think they were just doing a quick thing. Supposedly, Inframan didn't even do that well in Hong Kong in the box office. It did better in America and in foreign markets where Joseph Brenner released it than Shaw Brothers did with it in Hong Kong.
Well, do you think that's why the Shaw Brothers didn't make more of these sort of Japanese-style action movies?
Yes, I totally believe it.
Because it's kind of an anomaly in the Shaw catalog. It's one of the weird ones in there.
It is, and it was bought by a different distributor who held a lock on it. It didn't go to World Northall with the old Ted Thomas dub or anything. And I think it may have been released in Japan, but flopped because they had no interest in something that was a foreign imitation of something they could see on TV every night.
Right.
And the funny thing is, some of the music it uses, some of the stock library music, and this is in both versions, the Hong Kong and the American, is music from Ultra 7.
Okay.
So the Shaws, they probably didn't pay for it, but nobody cared, you know. However, Joseph Brenner did have the movie rescored a bit by a musician using a Moog keyboard, but I actually like it. When you see that in a theater and see that in stereo, it sounds amazing. Like there was just
the one
nothing...
I heard was just this crummy mono. Like it just sounded like
it's
shit.
It's a throbbing, aggressive, bassy mono. If you see it, the stereo version. If you see it in the mono, crappy. Because god damn it, Image Entertainment. To get back to this, Image Entertainment, when they were doing the English track, guess which VHS version they chose to put the English audio track on there.
Which version?
Did they use the Prism stereo version?
No.
No. They used the Good Times 4-hour speed audio from that videotape and here's what's so dumb. I know a guy who offered them the Prism pre-record in great condition to use for the English track, and they turned him down.
Oh, great.
Because they thought they knew it all.
No, it's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, go away, nerd. You know?
Exactly. That was their whole attitude. They fucked up. So we have this kind of very imperfect release of Inframan.
Yeah.
Because kids who saw this in the 70s, I know a lot of kids who saw this in the theater in the 70s. And of course, now they're all like lawyers and doctors and probably don't even remember seeing it. But it's like so many people saw it in the 70s, all saw it with the soundtrack. And it's not really there on DVD. It's like you cannot watch it with that really wonderful stereo track. It's stupid. And just to show you these Image, even a company like Image, they fuck up. All right, let's get that clear.
And do you think the treatment of the English track also has something to do with sort of the snobbery that goes in here?
Oh, I bet.
Where
I
it's
bet
like, it it's like, well, it's the English track. I mean, it's imperfect. It's impure. Who cares? We're going to give the 5.1 mix to the Mandarin track. And, you know, we won't give a shit about we'll have a mono track just because if you like your mono tracks, and then the American track, which just sounded like crap.
Fucking idiots. Hundreds of thousands kids saw it in the theaters with that English track in the 70s. Very popular film. I don't know if they've ever tallied how much it grossed back then, because here's the thing. It was released in 1976, four-walled across the country. Mm-hmm. It was released again in 1978, four-walled across the country, stretched into 1979. I saw it in 1979. I remember following its release in the theaters that I would look at the newspaper ads. Held over, second big week. Held over, third big week. It was making money. And it's kind of like Godzilla versus Megalon. That was an import that was released by a company called Cinema Shares out of New York, just like Inframan was released by Joseph Brenner and Associates out of New York. Mm. And I don't think they reported their rentals the way major studios did. Godzilla vs. Megalon is believed to have made a fortune in America in 1976. Inframan must have made a ton because they advertised the hell out of that thing.
Well, and I believe it because some of these Godzilla movies just have more of a reputation over here than others.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it just seems like that they became hits on the drive-in circuit or whatever, and that these people grew up remembering that specific movie, you know, which is pretty interesting. So one thing about Inframan that's different with the Shaw Brothers movies is that the action is very special effects-based. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not as, like, you have a lot of monsters with, like, you know, spring-loaded heads firing off and stuff. Like, because that was sort of different for the Shaw Brothers, right?
Yeah.
Having these sort of, because the action was, you had to kind of shoot around it, I guess. It was different.
Special effects, they storyboard it, supposedly.
Oh, they storyboarded it, okay.
The IMDb is to be believed, this is the first Hong Kong movie that had storyboards.
And it was written by the guy who wrote what seems to be every Hong Kong movie ever, Ni Kong.
Oh, yes. He is the sort of a very prolific Hong Kong screenwriter, and he was also a pulp writer.
He wrote pulps, yeah.
Wrote novels about characters like Dr. Y and Wisely. And Wisely was a science fiction writer / adventurer. And he created Wisely, I believe, before Indiana Jones was around. And Wisely was sort of like a Doc Savage of Hong Kong pulps. And they've made, I think, about three Wisely movies, including Legend of Wisely, which is excellent. And also Bury Me High, made by a different studio that's fantastic. And it was like the last really good Hong Kong movie of the early 90s. And after it, there was a more recent one that's been forgotten. And but E. Kong, like, seemed to write everything the Shaw Brothers produced, because I remember
it was like almost a joke. Like, I thought his name was like a pseudonym for, you know, the studio. Kind of like if you watch like an anime from Sunrise, I think you'd see it was created by Hajime Yatate, which was the pseudonym for the studio. You know, it was kind of like saying this song's written by Anthrax or whatever the band is. You know, though we're not giving specific credits out. So I thought, I saw his name on so many goddamn movies. I was like, well, obviously, this guy doesn't exist. But no, this guy apparently tossed off stories like in his sleep. Like, this guy wrote, he wrote so many things. He could just toss off a novel like in a weekend. You know?
Right. And those guys were prolific. And it may have also been how the language is structured a bit differently than English. So maybe there was an ability to write a lot. And maybe Cheng Che and Liu Jialiang were going to fill in the blanks or whatever. Because their movies are so stylistically different, even though Yi Kwong has supposedly written all these films.
Cheng Che's movies, they're very, like, almost, you know, lots of shirtless dudes, like, stabbing each other and dying.
Right. I don't think Yi Kwong put notes in his script. Lo Meng's going to have his shirt off and be tortured in the Iron Maiden.
And, you know, Cheng Che's going to be sweating behind the camera.
Right.
But
then Liu Jialiang has all this strange comedy and all this very noble, you know, spirit of the martial arts.
And, like, lots of philosophy in his movies.
Right,
like, what
right.
What does it mean to be a martial artist?
Right, the stuff you don't get in a lot of the other films, and I think that was Liu Jialiang's addition. So I think Yi Kwong probably just outlined the stories or gave him a story outline or whatever. There were some other really good screenwriters. Yeah,
lots of they fight in there.
Right. Barry Wong was the other great screenwriter who wrote a lot of the John Woo and Jackie Chan films and Aces Go Places films and worked on tons of these things and was just a really skilled screenwriter in balancing comedy and action. And when he passed away, that's when I really noticed the quality of Hong Kong movies going down. It wasn't just John Woo going to Hollywood, Ringo Lam making Hollywood deals. It was Barry Wong's death that seemed to end good filmmaking in Hong Kong. But Ikuang, I think, was pretty much retired by then. He does appear on camera. If you get the Golden Harvest movie, The Seventh Curse, which is another one of those wonderful fantasy, action, horror, layered movies that was actually a co-production between Shaw Brothers and Golden Harvest. And Ikuang is in the beginning of the film introducing it as himself, and basically because it crossed over two of his famous pulp heroes, Wisely and I think Dr. Y, or I forget who the other character was. Chai Yun Fat is playing Wisely, and Chin Shao Ho, I think, is playing Dr. I believe he's playing Dr. Y. I might be wrong on that, though.
So
you could check the internet for the truth about the Seventh Curse, but that's Ikuang's big film. And yeah, most people don't know it's a Shaw Brothers Golden Harvest co-production.
And he was, if the internet, if you can believe Wikipedia, apparently he was a guy who passed death sentences in communist China. Like, he's,
whoa.
Did you know this?
No.
It says, and this is Wikipedia, so who knows? But it says,
yeah,
he was born in Ningbo, Zhejiang, but grew up in Shanghai. He worked as a public security official under the Chinese Communist Party government in the 1950s in Inner Mongolia and was tasked with writing death sentences. He once questioned the local party chief about why a particular man was sentenced to death, and when the offense he committed, as stated on paper, was for being a landlord. The chief threatened to execute him if he continued to ask questions. According to Ni, he complied with the order because he feared for his own life. This was not the only instance in which he was wrote a questionable death sentence, which was categorized under others by the Chinese Communist Party government. These experiences made him decide to escape from China to Hong Kong in 1957.
I think this is probably true.
I doubt that's made up.
I think it's true because Dr. Yun, that was his other hero, Dr. Yun. Oh, Dr. Y. I'm confusing with the Jet Li movie. Dr. Yun was his other hero, and there was the Wisely series. And, yeah, criticism of communism evident in his work. No wonder I love his stuff.
Yeah, it says he's an anti-communist on there.
And it's funny. This confirms he was a screenwriter for Fist of Fury, the Bruce Lee film, which it had always been rumored he'd silently contributed to, but it looks like they finally established, yeah, he did write the script. So that's why it's a little cut above some of the other Bruce Lee productions at the time.
He's a lover of personal freedom, which resonates in his
Yeah, mind. I like Ikuang's probably one of my favorite screenwriters.
And, oh, absolutely. I mean, he's...
And yet I cannot read his screenplays.
Yeah, exactly. He's still alive and kicking. He's still around.
In fact, he would probably get my vote as maybe my all-time favorite if I looked at the number of films he wrote that I love.
Yeah, that's one of those.
I think Ikuang would be the top screenwriter. He'd be my favorite screenwriter of all time.
He's written so many. I mean, so many great movies.
Yes, but it's like, obviously he has a great control of what works in a story, what works in a film,
yeah.
Thinking that way. That's something I don't see in movies today. They seem to be written by people who don't understand what makes a good movie.
Well, and a lot of them haven't worked a job, you know.
Right, and this guy was, good Lord, look at his biography, and then he goes into film writing. Good night. Inframan is just, also in the cast is like Terry Liu, who plays Princess Dragon Ma.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Princess Beelzebub, I believe, in the subtitles. And she was a Shaw Brothers bombshell. She mostly did erotic films in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she was one of their starlets who did nude scenes. And I've seen at least two or three films with her doing topless scenes. And when she left Shaw Brothers Studios, she did a Chan Wai Man movie where she had a major role and had that red hair and had some topless scenes and stuff. And I'm like... well, I finally see what's under Princess Dragon Mom's chainmail, you know,
Princess
with this Chan Wai Man movie. Thank you so much, Chan Wai Man. But,
I love Princess Dragon Mom. That name just sounds like it's supposed to appeal to kids, the Dragon Mom.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Chinese Dragon Mom that's always on you about doing your homework and stuff.
Right, right, Princess Dragon Mom. And I love it. She speaks with Corey Noor doing her bitchy old witch voice. You know, like, because Corey Noor did Princess Dragon Mom's voice. And she also did the kids' voices, So it's like she's doing all the women in the movie is pretty much Corey Noor, who could always do those different, you know, she could do Trixie and then Speed Racer's Bomb's voice and stuff. So it was perfect. But yeah, it's just like I love the English dub, but boy, Image really screwed up not getting the stereo track and getting a nice so you could experience that audio.
You know, speaking of Shaw Brothers movies on DVD. It felt like for a minute there, a few years ago, there were so many Shaw Brothers movies pouring out on DVD. You had Image putting them out. You had Dragon Dynasty. You had Funimation. You had gosh, who's the other one?
Media Blasters.
And you had all these companies pouring out these Shaw Brothers movies for a second, and then all of a sudden, nothing.
Right.
Like, it was this floodgate opened, and every day I'd go to the video store. It was like Christmas. Oh, this week we got Five Element Ninja. Oh, this week we got King Boxer. Oh, this week we got, Return to the 36th Chamber. You know, it was always something, and then just nothing, you know.
Right.
And do you know what's up with that? Was it just like Celestial gave license out a bunch of stuff, people released them, and then but people stopped buying DVDs, or what is it?
It's a combination of a few things. Image was the first company to make a deal with Celestial, and Image fucked up releasing a bunch of films that were of no interest to American collectors. They released some erotic drama. No one cared.
They put out some weird, obscure ones.
They put out stuff in the 60s, like a sequel to a Monkey King movie, a sequel, part two of a trilogy.
Oh, good.
Of Monkey King films. It's a musical. In a fantasy.
And they put out one of my favorites, The Boxer's Omen.
Yeah, they put out Boxer's Omen, which
is a weird movie.
And Seeding of a Ghost and some of these other, like, some of the real crazy early 80s gore films. They were trying to appeal to different markets, like horror, and they were trying to get the horror market. They didn't emphasize the martial arts as much. They thought, and I think it's because Dragon Dynasty, Miramax already bought an option on a bunch of those kung fu films before Image made their deal, but Image got their DVDs out first. And a lot of their titles were just of no interest to the American collectors. And I think it's also because Celestial didn't really understand their library. It was bought. So Celestial's a Malaysian company that bought the library to provide content for their satellite channel in Asia.
Okay.
Then they realized, oh, we can repackage, we can release these in Hong Kong and call them this classic Hong Kong cinema that hasn't been seen in decades. Because here's a funny thing. Shaw Brothers films, with the exception of a few Laserdisc releases on Ocean Shores in Hong Kong, were never issued on videotape in Hong Kong or the Chinatown markets. Although Rainbow Audio and Video, that became the horrid Tai Sing, did release a number of their 60s films. It's strange. It's their libraries handled so bizarre. And then so the Image stuff didn't sell great. Media Blasters got a hold of a lot of good titles. Released them, didn't have a ton of success either because the market was burned out. There was already some bootlegs out on the market by this this idiot in New York named Stiller learned how to get his bootlegs into Best Buy and Media Blaster or Media Play, excuse me, and some other chain stores and on Amazon. So he kind of cut off some of the Media Blasters sales. Media Blasters didn't have the legal power to get that stuff pulled or didn't have the smarts to. I don't know what went on there, but Media Blasters put out some really nice DVDs, including a Blu-rays of some titles like Five Element Ninja. Supposedly, like titles like Five Element Ninja sold out.
Yeah, Five Element Ninja. But I bought instantly.
Yeah, Media Blasters currently exists mainly as a streaming licensor, but they have apparently expressed interest in actually repressing the Five Element Ninja Blu-ray because it sold so well. It sold out practically in pre-order. You couldn't get a hold of it after a week. But Media Blasters kind of collapsed under their own weight. There was a lot of decisions, a deal with Toho, with releasing some Godzilla movies that
that went crazy.
Absolutely screwed them over. And they were also spread very thin on anime releases. Dragon Dynasty, which was the Miramax subsidiary the Weinstein company, they release stuff with commentary by Bay Logan. Here's the thing. In America, nobody cares who Bay Logan is. They just don't care. And another thing, Bay Logan actually doesn't know a lot about Shaw Brothers films. His specialty is Golden Harvest and Hong Kong movies of the 80s made by independent companies because that's when he moved there.
Yeah.
He didn't know much about Shaw Brothers films. And it's
they should have gotten Rick Meyer, right?
No. he doesn't know anything about any of that stuff. They got the RZA to do the commentary in 36 Chamber of Shaolin, but that was it.
That was a really good commentary, too.
And maybe that's all the RZA was good for, was one movie, and that's all he wanted to do. And they had Tarantino and Elvis Mitchell do the commentary on King Boxer, which I don't find to be a terribly informative commentary.
Elvis, this part right here. Oh, my God. This part right here, it's oh, my, you know,
So, Quentin, you want to talk about the sting right here? What you use in Kill Bill?
Yeah, Elvis should have spent more time talking about smuggling money over the Canadian.
What was it on their release of Tai Chi Master? Police Story 2.
Yeah.
It had Elvis Mitchell and Brett Ratner.
Oh, my God. Commentary from hell. What the hell is Brett Ratner going to tell you about what guys he finds hot? Jackie looks really hot in this scene.
He's sitting there in his fucking – he looks like fucking Nice Guy Eddie from Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, my God. Here's the thing. When they released those, they put out great titles. They put out King Boxer, 36 Chambers Shaolin, My Young Auntie, One-Arm Swordsman.
Yeah.
You couldn't ask for more. Problem was, they were retailing at $15 in Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the people who buy these films, they don't want to spend a lot of money on them.
And the thing is, they already have bootlegs of them.
Correct. They're not going to be eager to, you know, they're not the type of people going to the Criterion sale at Barnes & Noble.
No. And you know what was fucking pretentious as hell about these releases? They had spine numbers.
Oh, that was so dumb. I mean, no sense.
Why do they need spine? It's ridiculous.
First of all, Hong Kong cinema is not all the same. These are different genres. Police Story 2 is not the same type of film as Five Venoms.
Yeah.
It just isn't. But the way they priced them was terrible. Here's the cool thing. They're all still in print. You can still get the Dragon Dynasty releases. They're all excellent.
I've got most of them. I mean,
I wouldn't recommend grabbing any of them. They're very cheap right now because the Weinsteins changed the manufacturer, and the new manufacturer said, we're going to put these out super cheap. So you can get these terrific Liu Jialiang movies and Chang Che films packaged in like these 4-on-1 set deals for like $10 on Amazon.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You can own 4 of the best Shaw Brothers movies, like Executioners of Shaolin, for like basically $250
a pop. Heroes from the East.
You have no reason not to buy those if you are interested in these.
Come drink with me and Golden Swallow.
Exactly. On one pack, it's perfect. And the transfers are terrific. And they maintain the bonuses if you want Bay Logan's commentary or whatever. They did a good job, but it's like the DVD market was quieting down. They were overpriced when they came out. These were of the interest to blue collar people. Mm-hmm. It's like these are not college snob films. I don't care how much Quentin Tarantino loves them. Film professors always hated these films.
You know who didn't though?
Who?
Werner Herzog.
Yes, I mean movie buffs. There's movie buffs that love them, but they're not like mainstream of movie buffs. They're basically, these are the type of stuff you really should have retailed them for like $7.99 each.
The films of Jean-Luc Godard are intellectual counterfeit money compared to a kung fu film.
Yes, right.
That's what Herzog said.
He's totally right. And and to tell you the truth, instead of wasting money hiring Bay Logan to supervise the release and getting Brett Ratner on these things, why not just pay the RZA to promote the releases on social media?
Yeah.
Now, Twitter may have not been as big a thing back when these were coming out, but you get somebody like the RZA to sort of be your spokesman, not Bay Logan. Nobody cares about Bay Logan in America. They just don't care. It just comes off like a pompous.
Nobody's ever heard of him either. You know,
yeah, they don't know who he is.
Yeah, he might as well be Jerry from next door. Like,
there's exactly. Hey, Bob the mechanic who worked on your transmission last week. He's going to do the commentary. He speaks some Cantonese. So, It's just like,
and plus, you get the black community in there, you know.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
They love that shit. They love.
Oh no, this is another problem that these distributors always think this is a white nerd thing. It is not.
Nope.
White. Kung fu movies were never the problem.
Hey, they're karate movies, all right.
Karate flicks, you know. That's the market. And I'm not being bigoted or stereotyping or anything. I'm just talking the truth.
John actually is black, believe it or not. You know,
that's the core. That's the core audience for this stuff, is blue collar black audiences. That's what you market to, and get Big Daddy Kane to introduce the films. He loves this stuff. He knows more about Shaw Brothers movies than Bay Logan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you could go on and on about how they've blown the releases of these on home video. And also did not help that the DVD market was starting to, you know, basically suffer from inertia. The good news is that last year El Rey made the deal with Celestial to release at least 200 of these films on their channel, because Robert Rodriguez is supposedly a big Shaw Brothers movie fan.
Yeah.
Or he recently became one. So he's got them. They're playing on his TV station. If you have El Rey on your cable service, you can watch, I think, up to 4 Shaw Brothers movies a day, widescreen, English dub. They've dug out the English dubs whenever they can. You can watch these rarities like My Rebellious Son in English.
Ice-T was on his podcast going, yeah, on this El Rey network, they're showing these karate movies, man. So you got to check it out. They say there like, I killed your father, but still, what's more? What's
more? I got to start listening to his podcast. But it's a good thing because at least, and this is a big problem I had with the DVD releases from 10 years ago. These films had not been seen regularly on television since like 1989.
Yeah.
There's a whole generation
since
that
Black
never
Belt Theater went off the air, right?
Right, Black Belt Theater, because World Northall actually went out of business in like 1986, but their TV licenses were still good at those stations where they could still air their movies for another 3 years. So once those were off TV, the audience for this started to quiet down, where it became a hardcore cult until the Wu-Tang Clan album was released. But by then, none of the Shaw films were legit available on American home video. So you had that audience just kind of, there was no new generation getting into these like I did when I was a kid. You don't have the kids of the 90s understanding what these films are. They're getting into Dragon Ball Z and Jackie Chan, but they're not getting into the Shaw Brothers movies. And so the cool thing about the El Rey broadcast is it will create a new generation of fans, because constant repetition of showing these on television is what creates a film following. Yeah. That's what creates a cult. It's not having these things sit in a vault for 3 decades.
No, like just a small run at the theater doesn't do shit. You know,
it's
sitting on a shelf.
Out there,
you know?
Get them on television. You get this stuff on television. I've been told by a guy who was one of Bruce Lee's top students and taught his class and everything. He told me Jackie Chan is much more popular than Bruce Lee these days. Young kids don't know who Bruce Lee is. Bruce Lee's movies, too violent to show on television all the time. Also, he only made like 4 complete films, so you can't show them on TV repeatedly. You're going to burn the market out. Shaw Brothers films, you've got all this to choose from. Jackie Chan had way more movies, you know, you could show on television all the time, create that youthful following, that you have to create new fans, or the genre just dies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Westerns are getting a nice comeback because they're on television all the time. People get past their 20s. They want something a little slower for entertainment. I know, because I definitely reached that point. They start getting into watching Westerns. That's how you create that new audience. And you have to keep the product out there. Toho has always been very pissed off that Henry Saperstein bought the Godzilla movies from them for nearly nothing, mm-hmm. and made a fortune off of them on television and in theaters. And the same thing with AIP. AIP licensed them for almost nothing.
And isn't that why Toho's they're such pricks about their licensing now?
Exactly. They're so bitter about that. But what they don't get is AIP got those movies on television in the 60s and 70s, and they played all the time, every weekend, and that created the fandom. Same thing with Henry Saperstein. He got the films out there, and they got into theaters. They got double features in theaters. Television, you know, broadcasted. That creates the following. It's like a TBS broadcast of Rumble in the Bronx is going to have more viewers in a week, if they play it a few times in a week, than probably as many people saw it in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the odds. That's just the random odds of television viewing. That's how you create a fan following. You have to show the films. You cannot hide them. Not everybody can get away with the Disney strategy of pulling movies from circulation every 5 years, you know, and then
I hate that Disney strategy. Oh God.
It's so douchey. And now
when you work at a video store, you have to explain to at least 5 people every day why they can't get Aladdin on DVD or whatever. And they have to put them on a waiting list, you know?
The funny thing is, if you go to a thrift store, and you will always find loads of Disney VHS.
Oh yeah. Oh, there.
Any out of print Disney movie on VHS.
The video store I worked at, the VHS section, the only stuff that sold was the Disney stuff. That's the only VHS stuff we moved at that store was Disney stuff. In fact, if you came to sell VHS tapes, they stopped taking anything except family stuff. Because it was always grandmas coming in and buying a bunch of VHS tapes for their place for when the kids came over.
Yeah, so, and I'll even tell you here in my upstairs where I'm recording this right now, which is unusual. Usually I do it in my basement. But upstairs under the television set is a ton of VHS. It's all Disney films and clamshells because they're convenient to pop into the VCR for my kid.
Yeah.
And they were given to us. They were just stacks of these things that his cousins outgrew. And so we have all this Disney VHS. So, you know, it's still cheaper than trying to get these damn things on Blu-ray and DVD. And most of them are not available right now. So, right. You know, but you have to have that availability to create that audience. And I love it that they're showing on the El Rey network all the time. I wish El Rey had a Roku stream in high def. But the fact that people are enjoying Alexander Fu Xing movies dubbed in English is fantastic to me. I think it's just great news.
Yes.
Oh, I also forgot. Wellgo USA was another company that put out Shaw Brothers films in this country, and they're still around.
Oh, yeah.
They're releasing Ip Man 3 in theaters in January, but they screwed up because what they did was they put out some good discs that I own. They also put out some garbage discs, which were not in 16:9 and not anamorphic. And I asked them about that. Their last two releases of some rare movies were not anamorphic. And I asked them, in 2014, because this is when it happened, how could you release films not anamorphic and in standard? And they said, well, that's the prints that Celestial gave us. I go, well, you do know that their Region 2 releases were anamorphic and high def. So what the hell's up with your releases? You shouldn't have even released them. You should have refused it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not going to answer that. But they were condescending. They're like, we're just getting these out because we have a contract with them. And they're wasteful. I mean, I traded them in. I don't even want to own them.
Yeah.
It's like, and then I ordered the Region 3 versions from Region 2, Region 3, whatever it is, from Hong Kong. I was like, I'm not going to have these shitty DVDs just because they have an English track on them. I don't care. It's like, that's not enough reason to own this. I'll never watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these transfers, they weren't even good full frame transfers. They were bad. They look
bad,
like VHS tapes. They look like VHS tapes transferred to DVD. They look so bad. And that's a company still releasing Blu-rays and DVDs, putting that stuff out. They license a lot of these new Hong Kong movies to Netflix. And that they put out these shitty DVDs of Shaw Brothers films.
Ugh.
I'm like, you know, good. Put them all on El Rey Network if you're going to treat them like that.
You know what? We should be getting we should just go buy Johnny Ray Gasca's tapes.
It really so.
Everybody, yeah, just get Johnny Ray Gasca to do it.
This is videotape for the fifth row. Captures the subtitles better. The other one is videotape from the seventh row in the corner, so you can see the action better. You know, it's like
it'd be better than the George Tan DVDs, right?
It is so funny that I had a ton of Johnny Ray Gasca videotapes at the time. I did not know he was the guy that videotaped.
Yeah, if you want more of Johnny Ray Gasca, you know, filmmaker and criminal extraordinaire, go back into our archive and listen to our episode with the Prince of Piracy himself.
It's awesome, and it's quite a mind-blowing listen. And there's a lot of stuff about Shaw Brothers and, you know, Hong Kong.
There is.
Huge history. But Inframan, I hope somebody decides to put out a Blu-ray one day.
Yeah.
And either acquires the stereo track through a 35mm print or just finds the damn Prism VHS and transfers that audio.
The thing about Shaw Brothers Blu-rays, though, is that sometimes they look too good.
Yeah, they do.
You know, like sometimes you see all the wires, you see all the this, that. It's just, it's not meant to be like that. You know?
The worst is seeing the gum on Wang Lungwei's sideburns wigs.
Oh, that's terrible. That
you
can
see on his cheek.
And, like, sometimes you see, like, the corner of the sky.
Oh, the ripped sky set.
Yeah.
These hairs, you can see texture.
And it's part of the charm, but on Blu-ray, it's just a little too in your face, you know?
Well, it's like the Ray Harry. I never thought the Ray Harryhausen movies came off well in high def.
No, they don't. No.
Because they make the photographic effects just look like it's so obvious.
They stand out, you know?
Yeah, you're better off watching those on videotape, I hate to say, because it doesn't reveal too much.
Yeah, it's not Blu-ray is not always the most flattering format for film.
No, especially old movies.
Yeah.
Especially old movies. And I do want the Five Element Ninja Blu-ray if it's ever available, but
yeah,
they repress it all.
Come by. I just have the DVD. I never got
it's
the Blu-ray.
It's sold out immediately. It sold out so quick I couldn't get it.
Five Element Ninja is probably my favorite Shaw Brothers film. It's just so watchable. Like, that's one I show to people all the time.
My favorite is Heroes of the East, but
well, Heroes of the East is the best, I will say.
It's my favorite. It's my favorite martial arts movie. However, Inframan is my all-time favorite superhero film. I still have not seen a DC or Marvel movie top it.
That's his, that it's just in terms of pure enjoyment and fun. And
this like, is excitement. What I think these Marvel directors need to go back and watch this and see how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can learn from it, because actually one Hong Kong director, and his name escapes me, he's been making recent films. He said he wanted to do either a remake of Inferman, or he wanted to create a new Chinese superhero, because he really thinks that the Hong Kong China movie market could use a superhero film and prove that the Chinese can make something as good as the Americans.
Yeah.
On that level, and I hope he gets to make it, or at least get there. But I guess he got the Celestial DVD of Inferman and said, why aren't we remaking this film? Why aren't we trying to do something with this concept? You know, so it's like, maybe he'll get to make it. I don't know. It's like, it's a wait and see, but I would love to. I hate it that it was not successful enough in Hong Kong for them to make a sequel, because yeah. I love the film dearly. I've watched it maybe 20, 30 times. I will give you a little hint. May not be available soon, but on Amazon, you can watch a full frame version of Inframan. That is, the problem is it's not scoped, but it is the Joseph Brenner, and I think the audio is better than what you get on the image DVD. But okay. you're not seeing it in widescreen. It's a right. Panascan. Somebody basically transferred the Prism videotape hunt okay. for Amazon streaming. So
it's an imperfect product.
So I guess the Joseph Brenner version is sort of public domain in a way, because I don't know if Joseph Brenner is still with us. But it's too bad Joseph Brenner didn't make a deal with Image and then put out like a something from his master print or whatever.
That would have been really sweet.
Yeah, that would have been perfect, because the American version is superior. I really do believe it is. And I don't like the Kamen Rider sequence with the music and the march and stuff when that happens. I like the American version where you just hear the music and he flips and he's there.
Yeah.
You know? It's like drove us crazy in the theater when we were kids.
Okay.
And like I said, this movie had an effect on me that Star Wars had for other children.
Yeah.
To me, it was the most visually exciting film I'd
and
seen.
And you were reading the Super Inframan Expanded Universe novels?
Oh, boy. Yeah. I would have gone for those. In fact, I remember being a kid just looking in toy stores and stuff for any Inframan tie-in product.
Oh, my God.
Believe. I mean, it's like a perfect character for an articulate action figure.
Yeah, it is.
They didn't. They didn't do it.
I remember the best action figure I ever had in the, you know, when I was a kid, Power Rangers became a thing. And
because
Bandai
was putting those out in America.
Yeah, and they put out these Power Rangers action figures that were fucking awesome. They were so posed, but they had so many moving parts. They were just like, you could do anything with them. They were so cool. But yeah, like, and that's a show that's definitely, you know, cut from that same cloth.
Yeah, although the Sentais were not inspired by Inframan, or they're probably closer tied in with the what's known as Gatchaman, I think.
Oh, yeah, totally. I just mean they're cut from that sort
right.
of Japanese superhero.
Yeah, yeah,
cloth,
it's a tokusatsu style.
Tokusatsu,
the
there
high,
you go.
The high energy cutting and action and monsters and all that crazy stuff. And you'll notice the Inframan effects are very similar to the Toei TV shows when their monsters grow giant.
Yeah, I love that. I love that when the monsters get really big.
Yeah, so same like
the vine monster makes his big vines go through like buildings and stuff. So cool.
When Inframan fights like the bug creature, like the bug creature becomes gigantic. And it's literally the same photographic effect that you see in the Toei TV shows when the monsters become giant and they have to get in their robot and fight it or whatever. But yeah, just such a such a blast of a film. We didn't have to do a synopsis because this is actually such a popular cult film. I don't think we really have seen it too much. But the point of this podcast is to give you a little facts about it. And note that actually we're big fans. So there you go.
Well, I think, is there anything else you want to say about Inframan?
I don't know. You have any other questions?
No, I think we've covered it.
Stuck a memory. It's like, I don't know how many informative podcasts about Inframan I've ever
read. I love, I mean, it's a movie I love. I mean, I know you'd give it a 10 out of 10.
10, easy. Yeah. It's not, no question about it. I love it.
And I saw it when I was older. I'd probably give it like an 8. I mean, I think it's a lot of fun, but I think it's one I'd show to my kids for sure.
I tell you, when I was 7, this would have rated a 20.
Yeah, exactly. It would have been a 20 out of 10.
Yes, I would have. Man, I cannot. It's really hard to articulate how exciting this was to see. Like back when I was in second grade, like just had never seen a film like this.
Yeah,
with those sound effects. People underrate what sound effects, how effective they can be.
Oh, they're everything.
And I mean, I remember when I first heard that first sound of Inframan hitting the plant monster, those Shaw Brothers sound effects amplified. man, my heart rate went up. I hadn't heard anything like that in a movie before. It was just, it's stunning. And Americans, Hollywood doesn't even think about sound effects in that way.
Like, not anymore.
Like, they shouldn't grab your attention. No, they should totally grab your attention.
No, yeah. Like, I've noted in some movies, like the punch, some movie I saw recently where the punches just sounded weak.
Oh, they sound like you're hitting a pillow.
Give me those loud, like, you know, Shaw Brothers punches. Like, Indiana Jones's punches sounded like they were fucking smashing through, you know, stuff.
Yeah, very, very, you know, Harrison Ford's son is a big Hong Kong movie fan.
Oh, really?
And used to go to the Chinatown theater in near L.A., the Sun Sing, I believe, or whatever. And he bought the building and maintained the Chinese theater billboard, like, in the front, just to kind of keep that memory alive that it used to be the Chinatown theater.
That's really cool.
So I don't know if he dragged old Harrison down there. Oh, I like the sound effects of these movies. You know, I kind of carry. But I did like that about the Indiana Jones movies when he punches somebody.
Yeah, it
punches
sounds,
a Nazi. It sounds like the whip crack.
Yeah, it's like sheet, it sounds like their face is gonna cave in. It's awesome.
My dad always called it the hitting the sheets sound effects. It sounded like they were a stick and hitting a sheet hanging out in the wind.
Yeah,
you know, it's pretty true. Which is probably what they were doing.
Yeah, it probably was. Was it? Scorsese talked about the guy who did the punches for Raging Bull. He had all this fruit and stuff, and he did, had all this stuff he did. And Scorsese said that guy, like, he didn't want people ever reusing his effects, so he'd destroy it after, like, it got used or something.
Oh, yeah. Because you could hear Enter the Dragon sound effects being bootlegged into Dolomite movies. And
oh,
stuff.
Yeah.
It's.
And like the fucking Wilhelm screams in like every movie, you know, it's almost like a joke, you know, it's a joke that's like not funny anymore.
Oh, I know.
So I have a quick announcement to make for the show. Mm-hmm. At the end of the year, we're going to be offering some premium content. Now, the show is free. The show will always be free. The show will never be behind a paywall. That's not what's happening. However, as a sort of donation drive, you know, the show's incurs expenses, you know, with server, domain name, all that stuff. And, you know, in order to ease those expenses and on us, and by us, I mean Stuart, mm-hmm. we're going to, you know, have a special paid show at the end of the year that you can pay for and get for a small, small fee. It just helps us out with the expenses. It all goes back into the show. And I've spoken with Mr. Garrow about this, and it's going to be the Return of Garrow show. So it'll be a special one. I'm going to see if we can't get some. I'm not going to announce what, because I don't know if Stu has it, but there's some content I think we should share in there, maybe, for the premium listeners. But Garrow it'll be the show where Garrow comes back. As some of you might know, Garrow's had a bout with cancer recently, and he's on the upswing, and he's doing better. Not to worry, Garrow will still be with us, but he's been sick for a while, and that's why he hasn't been on the show. And so our return of that, we were going to have him back on a special premium episode, help incur the expenses, help us with the expenses, and you know. Thought it might be a fun thing for people to get in on.
Mm-hmm.
Anything to add, John?
We're basically going to try to make it a show where if you pay for it, it's going to be exceptionally. It'll be worth paying for.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
it's
just a fundraiser. It is not, like I said. We're still going to be the show is still going to be free. We're just going to have that one episode.
It's almost like a prize for donating, really.
Right. It's a money earner. You love the show. Help us keep it going. We're not going to go spend this on beer.
No.
You know, I don't do this for the money. I don't want
to.
No,
none of us do this for this is a hobby. It always will be. We know.
I'll put it this way. Somebody actually offered to carry our show on his channel. It was still in the works, but he wanted us to do it on video.
Nah, yeah.
And there was even the enticement of money, and it's just like we're audio only. We're audio only. Not, and I know we'll never make enough money off. We're not going to be like the, you know, one of these growing, exploding podcasts that makes tons.
No,
of money. But we think that listeners, you know, we need a little expense. You know, we got to cover some expenses here. It's not super expensive to do this show.
No,
it's not cheap. So it's like
it's what you would call a bad investment.
Right, right. It's not as bad as a restaurant, but it's sort of, there's maintenance fees involved.
Yeah, just so, no, it's in, you know, getting, you know, it's just to help us, you know, right, lighten that blow.
For those of you who, you know, you'd like to hear some like really crazy, exceptional, edgy content, well, it's just gonna be that one special fundraising
show.
Yeah,
and if Stu has it, I want to ask Stuart, because Garrow was like, you should put this on there. but I won't announce it because I don't want to make any promises I can't keep.
Right, right. And it's not, you know, we're not saying please donate $100 to listen. It's gonna be
It's gonna be.
Just chip in a couple of dollars. If like 100 of you do it, we're covered for like 2 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, you know. We're working on it though. We're gonna make it worth your while.
We will.
It'll be worth the Skrilla, as the RZA.
The Skrilla. It'll be worth the Cheddar.
Yes.
It'll be worth the greenbacks. It'll be worth the dead presidents.
That was always my favorite retitling. I've probably said it on the show before, but there was a Don Wong Dao movie called Bandits, Prostitutes, and Silver.
Great. All you need in life.
And when George Tan bootlegged it on video, he changed the title to Hoes, Thugs, and Skrilla.
Yeah!
So, because he knew, I'll give George Tan this, he's a scumbag, but he knew this. He knew what the market was.
Yep.
And he retitled it specifically for that market. Oh, and by the way, Xenon Entertainment, those horrible bootlegs they released in the 90s, fucking licensed to print money. They made so much money. It was ridiculous. And then the majors get involved releasing this stuff, and they lose money on it.
Yep.
So that just tells you that sometimes being an enthusiastic fan is a great way to inform yourself, and with good marketing sense, how to make money off something you love. So
yep.
That the Weinsteins are never going to figure that out.
No.
So,
in fact, yeah. I wonder if they make anything off their Weinstein company.
But anyway, I believe the Image Entertainment DVD of Inframan is still available.
Yep, it's worth getting.
Yeah, I'd still say get it. It's the best way to watch the film. It's a great transfer. The Mandarin version sounds good. But the English dub doesn't sound great. But, you know, it may not bother those of you who've seen this in the theater, and I realize that many of you have probably seen this that are listening right now.
Yeah. So, anyway, visit us at MidnightMovieCowboys.com.
Yes.
MidnightMovieCowboys@gmail.com. And drop us a line, leave us a review on iTunes, 5 stars, all that good stuff.
And also a reminder of our sister distribution network,
PhantomSway.com.
PhantomSway.com, lots of cool articles, links, and other podcasts that are pretty good that are kind of fall in with our style. Well, not completely, but they're there. Like in one podcast, I think, has an interview with Lloyd Kaufman, which would please you trauma fans, because God knows I'll never be on a podcast covering trauma movies. But I know they have their fans. But the PhantomSway.com, really good. Lots of cool stuff. Music, photography. And our podcast is now their Monday morning podcast that kicks off the week.
Mm-hmm.
So how about them apples? If
That's
they believe in us
stuff.
That much, I believe in them if they believe in us. So there you go.
Excellent. Fight. Okay. But anyway.
That's right, Earthlings. Earthlings.
Earthlings. Surface dwellers. Well, all right. I think that about does it for this week. I'm going to sign out. John Grace, adios.
Mahalo, Hunter Dusing.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.